Peter B. Collins News and Comment. It's Wednesday, February 19th, 2014. You're about to hear a former Roman Catholic nun call out Pope Francis for failure to act in the sex abuse crisis.
Smiling faces sometimes pretend to be your friend. Smiling faces show no traces of the evil that lurks within.
Can you dig it?
Smiling faces.
In the case of Mary Dispenza, the smiling face who raped her at the age of 7 belonged to her parish priest in East Los Angeles, and she now knows that that same priest molested at least 32 other individuals before he was removed from duty. Mary Dispenza has a powerful story to tell, and today in an in-depth interview released to subscribers, she has quite a bit to say, including, as you're about to hear in this excerpt, a direct call to Pope Francis to confront the problem. And over the course of the interview, she describes how disappointed she is that Francis has taken on other scandals at the Vatican related to the banks, related to issues of doctrine. But he not only has failed to deal with the sex abuse crisis and its cover-ups, but the man who orchestrated the cover-up in the case of Mary Dispenza, the now-retired archbishop and former cardinal in Los Angeles, Roger Mahoney, still wears a Roman collar and recently co-celebrated a mass in Rome with Pope Francis himself, at the very time when a UN commission was holding hearings in the Vatican related to its failures and the obstruction of efforts to bring justice for the victims of violations by members of the priesthood. Here's the excerpt from former nun Mary Dispenza.
I go back to Pope Francis. I think this is a time in the church that he has an opportunity to write a new chapter. And the sooner, the better. This will go on and on, on and on. And these kinds of positions you're sharing right now will go on and on. And it's not making the world a safer place for children, this kind of conversation that these persons are letter writing and sending out. And short of Pope Francis taking a real stand with some definite specific things that are going to happen and putting some force behind his words and taking action, children are still in danger. Children will still be harmed. Children will still be raped. And that's where we have to focus our time and our energy right now. It just keeps us stuck in a conversation of those for, those who are against. And in the meantime, more children are harmed.
Yeah.
And the one who holds the buck right now is Pope Francis. He really could do something very significant to make a new chapter, to change the course of history.
There's much more in my in-depth interview with Mary Dispenza. It's available for subscribers today and will be available for all in 2 weeks at peterbcollins.com. And we released this interview on the same day that there's more news from the Archdiocese of Los Angeles, which, as I mentioned, is where Mary Dispenza was raped by her parish priest. Today, the Archdiocese says it has settled a $13 million agreement with 17 victims. They were altar boys who were molested by a visiting priest from Mexico named Father Nicholas Aguilar Rivera. And he molested more than 24 boys in less than 9 months back in 1987. The same archbishop, Cardinal Roger Mahoney, who I mentioned, covered up for Aguilar Rivera. His underlings helped him leave the country, or at least told him that he was facing criminal charges and it would be a good idea to get across the border. And he is still at large and has not been brought to justice. So the $13 million agreement brings the total settlements from Los Angeles alone to $740 million. Worldwide, that amount is more than $2 billion. And consider that the priests take money from Catholics of all walks of life, including poor people, and pay it out in response to the crimes that they either were involved with or covered up. And in the case of Mahoney, it's pretty egregious. His assistant indicated to the offending priest that, quote, "I told him that it was likely the accusations would be reported to the police and that he was in a good deal of danger." And the priest notified the archdiocese that he was leaving and nobody tried to stop him. So he was formally charged way back in 1988, but remains at large and has not been required to pay any price for these alleged crimes. And there's more to the cover-up. Mahoney told a subordinate not to give the Los Angeles Police Department a list of altar boys who'd been at the parish where this wayward priest had last been assigned. Michael Hennigan, an attorney with the Archdiocese, said Mahoney didn't reveal the list of altar boys because he didn't believe any of the alleged victims were among them. So he was investigator, and Mahoney decided that he didn't want to upset innocent altar boys by asking them questions about whether this priest had molested them. So that's obstruction of justice. And Mahoney can try to rationalize it all he wants. But the bottom line is that he aided and abetted a sex offender in escaping justice. And in the interview with Mary Dispenza, she talks about how she actually had her own personal meeting with Mahoney. And she describes that while he extended an apology, it's been very hard for her to accept it and to try to reach some level of closure. And Mary Dispenza continues to work with SNAP, the survivors' networks of those abused by priests. And I found her to be very, very well-spoken and well-versed on these issues. While we're talking about nuns, an 84-year-old Roman Catholic nun named Megan Rice has been sentenced to 3 years in prison for breaking into the nuclear weapons complex at Oak Ridge, Tennessee. She was there with a group of other protesters. The crime? Well, they walked through a facility that wasn't properly secured. And when they got in, they defaced some of the walls with spray-painted messages. Yeah, graffiti. And so the judge has sentenced this 84-year-old nun to 3 years in prison. Others who broke in with her got 5 years. And this is what's rich. Before she was sentenced, Megan Rice, the nun, asked the judge to sentence her to life in prison, even though the guidelines called for about 6 years. "Please, have no leniency with me," she said. "To remain in prison for the rest of my life would be the greatest gift you could give me." Well, at age 84, 3 years may be the rest of her life. I want to thank the people who subscribe to the podcast and support my work here at peterbcollins.com. Ray Welch does more than he has to every month. Beth Daniel is a regular contributor. Michael Powell and Mark Shapiro just renewed for another year. Thank you, one and all. And I'd like to invite you to join their ranks. Go to peterbcollins.com right under my picture on the homepage. Follow the link that says sign up. And you can choose $5, $10, $20 a month, whatever fits your budget. Our best deal is the $50 annual subscription. And if you're a new annual subscriber from the continental U.S., I will reward you with a copy of John Dist's rock and roll CD called Red Flag, a lot of great tunes on there, and a bag of kick-ass Kona coffee, lovingly grown and hand-picked on the Big Island of Hawaii by Russ Archibald and his colleagues. So get on board today. I would love to reward you. The other way you can help us, whether or not you are a subscriber, is to take our offer for a free trial at audible.com. You sign up for a free 30-day subscription there. You can cancel any time, and if you cancel before 30 days, you don't owe them a penny. But just for trying it out, Audible will give me $15, and they'll give you your first audiobook download absolutely free from their catalog of 150,000 titles. The information and the links are embedded in the show file for this podcast, and you can also just click on the banner ad on the left-hand side of the homepage at peterbcollins.com. The situation in Ukraine is spiraling out of Kiev and perhaps out of control. At least 25 people have died in the first round in Kiev. And if you saw the pictures on television last night, it is quite a conflagration. The protesters were attacked by police and military, and they responded by setting the entire Independent Square on fire. And they're pretty good at what they're doing because it did push back on the police attack. And a number of police vehicles were caught up in the flames. Now, this is not a simple good guy, bad guy situation. I'm not an expert on Ukraine, but my impression is there are no heroes in this picture. The government, run by Yanukovych, isn't clean. And the protesters, whose beef is generally that they want to align with Europe and not with Russia, well, it's a real mixed group of people. Some of them are extreme, hard-line, authoritarian types. Some are anti-Semitic. And so it's not just a simple, you know, people's revolution. And I'm very concerned because today President Obama said that, without mentioning explicitly what he might do, that if this continues, there may be some reaction from the world community. And certainly any non-intervention, non-military steps that the U.S. can take to bring peace to Ukraine would be welcome. But any threats of military action, with NATO or in a unilateral mode, would be extremely risky, and I can't find any basis on which the United States would take action like that. Well, last night I got a chance to catch up with Rachel Maddow's program on MSNBC, and while there was more reporting on the Chris Christie bridge scandal that could have been condensed to about 2 minutes, and it spanned maybe, I don't know, 15 or 20 minutes, I give Rachel credit because she led with live pictures from Kiev, and offered a decent explanation, although she didn't define the opposition the way I just did for you. The other interesting thing when she was able to get beyond New Jersey is that Rachel Maddow showed in a graphic way that earthquakes probably caused by fracking operations have been frequent and, you know, happening almost hourly, multiple times a day, in the states of Oklahoma and Texas. And finally, citizens are getting up in arms about this. In Texas, they're complaining about the air pollution that comes from fracking sites. The state of Texas denies that there is any problem. But Texas has also seen very odd patterns of earthquakes near fracking sites. Likewise, in Oklahoma, Maddow showed that the spike in earthquake reports, many of which are above 2.5 on the Richter scale, that they spiked so much that they had to reconfigure the graph to get the vertical bar to fit on the video screen. Meanwhile, Tom Steyer, a billionaire from here in San Francisco, is getting the desired effect from his threats to spend tens of millions of dollars, up to $100 million, against political candidates of either party who deny climate change science or who are seen as enablers for the extractors and the climate science deniers. And I have mixed feelings about this, because when you see the money that the Koch brothers can marshal to promote their odious agenda, the first reaction is to say, well, finally, there's a rich fucker on our side. Pardon my language, I couldn't resist. But the big picture is that this is not democracy. It's a battle of the 1%. It's an intra-battle of the ultra-rich. And so, I have these conflicted feelings because Tom Steyer, for example, is ballsy enough to put money behind messages against Mary Landrieu, the nominally Democratic senator from Louisiana, the senator from oil and gas who was just appointed to run the Energy Committee in the Senate in an effort to save her seat and get her reelected this fall. But I still cringe when I think that you and I will be the little people who cover our heads as the giants hurl rocks at one another. And all we can do is kind of cower and hope we don't get caught in the crossfire. Meanwhile, the Obama Energy Department, which is being run by the ponytailed Secretary of Energy, Ernest Moniz, formerly of MIT, they've announced that they are going to approve $6.5 billion in the first tranche of federal loan guarantees for the construction of a new nuclear power plant near Augusta, Georgia, about 30 miles southeast. The plant is called Votel, V-O-G-T-L-E. Total cost estimated $14 billion. But Wall Street is not willing to float the debt to the Southern Company, which is the utility that is leading the construction project there. And this would be the first new nuclear reactor built in this country in decades. Now, I'm opposed to this. I am not, 1,000% opposed to nuclear power, but I can't support it when we haven't dealt with the waste issue, when Fukushima shows us that these plants are vulnerable to earthquakes and other extreme weather events that can lead to meltdowns, and I refuse to put taxpayer money at risk when the private sector, the vaunted free market, isn't willing to take any risk on a facility like this. And frankly, the conditions I just stipulated mean that I'll probably never, ever support the construction of another nuclear power plant in the United States. And I don't agree with some people who are on the left side, the green side, who say, well, it's a trade-off, but nuclear power doesn't produce a smokestack carbon emission. Therefore, it's less bad, less evil from as compared to coal or even natural gas for the generation of electricity. But I think that's a compromise and a Hobson's choice, because the risks that I just cited, and in addition, every nuclear power plant throws off so much heat that they need to be near a river or a sea or some other source of massive amounts of water to be able to cool the reactor cores. So it's a lose-lose proposition and another black mark on the environmental record of the Obama administration. Today I conducted an interview about the proposed merger of Comcast and Time Warner Cable, valued at $45 billion, with a man who sat on the Federal Communications Commission a few years back and cast the lone vote against the Comcast-NBC-Universal merger. His name is Michael Copps, and in this excerpt from the Processing Distortion interview that'll be released tomorrow at BoilingFrogsPost.com, Copps explains why he is adamantly opposed to this Comcast merger.
I think that this merger is really something that should be dead on arrival at the Department of Justice and the Federal Communications Commission. I believe it runs roughshod over consumer choice and competition. From what I know of it, it appears to be an affront to the public interest. It's just beyond the pale for one company to have that kind of reach and that kind of power, especially in a market where consumer costs keep rising and there is such little competition. And now you're taking that power that Comcast has in distribution, in broadband, in programming, in content, in new media, in old media, and extending it over to the Time Warner Cable marketplace, too. I just, for the life of me, cannot see how that serves the public interest, and I think it damages not only, as I say, consumers and competition, but the very civic dialogue, our news and information infrastructure, upon which, in the last analysis, self-government depends.
That's Michael Copps, former FCC commissioner, slamming the proposed merger of Comcast and Time Warner Cable. You can hear the full interview released tomorrow over at BoilingFrogsPost.com. We've got another domestic terrorism case that will not be heard in court. We'll never be able to see all the evidence, because the defendant has taken a guilty plea just a week before the trial was about to start. His name is Jose Pimentel, and he was being tried in state court in New York, the trial being held in Manhattan. And it's very interesting because the FBI, which conducts most domestic terrorism cases and usually inserts a paid informant and an agent provocateur who sets up the crime and then busts the guy just before he's about to pull the trigger, the FBI declined to prosecute Jose Pimentel. I find that quite strange, given the pattern of the FBI's behavior. And he took a plea where he'll agree to serve 16 years in prison, 5 years probation, because he was facing 15 to life under the original charges. Once again, we have a schlub. This guy's 29 years old, a Dominican native who converted to Islam, a guy who was down on his luck, who was plied by his police handlers with free food and marijuana. And then he apparently built a pipe bomb with an informant named Abdul back in November of 2011 after getting the instructions from Inspire magazine, which was run by Samir Khan, the man who was killed by a drone strike at the same time as Anwar al-Awlaki, and they were both American citizens, as you may recall. So the arrest of Pimentel stemmed from a sting operation by the New York Police Department's Intelligence Division. They used an undercover cop, two confidential informants, and hundreds of hours of recorded conversations. So we have another setup and takedown of a resident of the United States on charges, alleged charges of terrorism. And once again, as the government's case collapses, they squeeze out a guilty plea, and as I noted at the start, we will never get to see the evidence in this case and be able to evaluate just how much entrapment was involved in this plea arrangement. Ed Snowden was elected by the students of Glasgow University as their rector. He is supposed to hold the post for the next 3 years. And a rector at Glasgow University basically represents students when they take up issues with the administration. Now, it's pretty symbolic because Snowden can't go to Scotland. From what I know, we do have an extradition treaty. And if he went to Scotland to take up this post, he would be grabbed and brought to the United States to be tried under the spurious charges of the Espionage Act that have been brought by the Obama administration. Ed Snowden taking the high road, quote, "I am humbled by and grateful to the students of Glasgow University for this historic statement in defense of our shared values. If we do not contest the violation of the fundamental right of free people to be left unmolested in their thoughts, associations, and communications, to be free from suspicion without cause, we will have lost the foundation of our thinking society. The defense of this fundamental freedom is the challenge of our generation, a work that requires constructing new controls and protections to limit the extraordinary powers of states over the domain of human communication." He's a pretty eloquent guy. He's only 30 and doesn't even have a college degree. A high court in Britain, including a judge whose name is Lord Justice Laws, I have not made this up, has ruled, this three-judge panel, that Glenn Greenwald's gay partner, David Miranda, when he was detained at Heathrow Airport last July, that detention was lawful. And it's a real stretch. It truly is. Now, I have to say that Sibel Edmonds and others have raised valid questions about why David Miranda was traveling essentially as a mule with a hard drive that we're told had 58,000 purloined NSA files. It was an encrypted drive, but we're told that he had the passwords with him, either in a notebook or on a, you know, some other computer or somewhere on his person. Still, he was unable to open the files or unwilling to when he was held for over 9 hours at Heathrow Airport as he transited from a flight from Berlin to London and then on to Rio de Janeiro, where he lives with Greenwald. Now, I remain puzzled as to why they decided to move the files in that manner, knowing that Heathrow was a place that they could be intercepted, detained. They'd already seen the Guardian newspaper in Britain facing blistering criticism from the government, being forced to destroy a hard drive with its copies of the Snowden files. So I have to say, in terms of spycraft, this was not a smart move. But that said, Miranda was detained as a suspected terrorist under terrorism laws. And at worst, he was an accessory to journalism. And the law in Britain that was used to detain him, called a Schedule 7 stop, was intended to investigate people who were suspected of connections to terrorism. So Lord Justice Laws, what a name, wrote in his decision, "In my judgment, the Schedule 7 stop was a proportionate measure in the circumstances. Its objective was not only legitimate, but very pressing." And they argue, taking the government of Britain's position, that because the files included names of spies and other operatives, names that have to date never been released by Greenwald or the other journalists who have access to the Snowden documents, this was a potential crime. And it is such a stretch for the British justices, jurists, to be claiming that this posed some imminent threat to the national security of the United Kingdom. David Miranda said he'll challenge the decision. "I will appeal this ruling and keep appealing until the end, not because I care about what the British government calls me, but because the values of press freedom that are at stake are too important to do anything but fight until the end." Former Conservative Shadow Home Secretary David Davis in Britain said that when the counterterrorism law was passed, it was never thought that its powers could be used against journalists. "There can be no suggestion that Miranda was a terrorist or that he was seeking to abet terrorism, and it was for these purposes that this power was given to the politicians and the security agencies. Finally today, I want to comment on a great piece on Frontline, the PBS investigative series, airs on Tuesday nights on most PBS stations. And they took a look at the world of likes, Facebook and other social networks. And I think it's fascinating, and if you haven't seen it, I recommend that you find some time to watch it, either on a replay on your PBS station or by watching it online at pbs.org. But what I found fascinating is that Frontline went deep on the social media marketing run by huge Los Angeles agencies promoting the recent Hunger Games sequel. And if you don't know about Hunger Games, it's a series of books, and we have now two movies. I initially resisted seeing the films because, the description didn't captivate me. So against my will, I went to see the first film long after it was released, and then I saw the sequel a couple of weeks ago. And Hunger Games is this dystopian future scene where the government has an annual competition where they draw somebody from each, what we would call a state. And these people don't volunteer generally. They are selected against their will to participate in the Hunger Games, where only one individual will survive. And the games are these concocted reality zones that are centrally controlled by a group of people in a kind of Star Trek control room. And they can cause rain or sun. They can bring in big waves and a storm. They have complete control over whatever the size of the theater is where the Hunger Games are played out. And I found this fascinating because the metaphor applies to Facebook. And particularly in the commercialized aspects of Facebook, where individuals say, I like Hunger Games. And when they do that, they're acting as free volunteer promoters for a Hollywood movie producer. And they are manipulated in the same manner that the contestants in the Hunger Games are manipulated by the government masters and the individuals who control the game. And so I invite you to think about this. If you haven't already, watch the latest episode of Frontline. And if you have seen the Hunger Games or read the books, I invite your comment. Maybe you have something to add to my reading of this interesting interplay between the false reality of Hunger Games and the false reality of the social community at Facebook. But don't let that stop you from liking me. Go to Peter B. Collins Show and click that like button, will you? I'm desperate. I need to be liked. Please.
Happy trails to you until we meet again. Happy trails to you. Keep smiling until then.